You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We are a global NGO with research experts in 23 different countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. In our podcasts, we will outline and interrogate the latest issues related to business and human rights, bringing together diverse expertise from frontline activists, civil society, companies, investors, and academia. In this series, we are partnering with the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights to mark the 10th anniversary of the UN Guiding Principles and look forward to what the next decade might hold. Over the course of four episodes, we will examine the impact and reach of the UNGPs since they were introduced through a different thematic lens each week. We'll explore the impact, gaps, and opportunities as we look forward to the next 10 years.
Welcome to our podcast on the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights and Mandatory Due Diligence. My name is Mauricio La Sala. I'm Deputy Director at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We are here today with Anabella Cibrian, who is the Director of Protection International in Mesoamerica, an international NGO that works to improve the protection of human rights defenders by supporting them to develop their security and protection plans, mostly focused in Central America. We are also here today with Joanne Carling, who is an indigenous activist from the Philippines and who has been defending land and environmental rights of indigenous peoples for over 20 years. She is the Global Director of Indigenous Peoples' Rights International, a global indigenous peoples organization that works to protect indigenous peoples' rights. Joanne also co-convenes the Indigenous Peoples' Major Group for Sustainable Development. And we are also here with my colleague Johannes Blankenbach, who is our senior EU regional researcher and representative to provide a perspective from Europe. The UN Guiding Principles, that I'm going to refer to as the UNGPs, provide a globally agreed upon standard and framework for states and companies to prevent, address, and remedy human rights abuses linked to business operations. Since their adoption 10 years ago, the concept of human rights due diligence, which was first introduced by the UNGPs, has seen increasing uptake in policy frameworks and is currently at the center of legislative developments, particularly in Europe, but in other regions as well. Building out regulatory responses to businesses' human rights impacts is also a key issue for the UN Working Group efforts to scale up implementation of the UNGPs over the next 10 years. This episode will discuss the role mandatory measures can play in further driving respect for human rights in business, what mandatory measures need to look like to be effective, and how can we make mandatory due diligence work across regions. I would like to start with a simple and general question, which is, what do we mean by mandatory due diligence, and why is it needed, and why now? If we can start with you, Joanne, please.
Yes, thank you for that, Mauricio. When we talk of mandatory due diligence for corporations, this means there will be specific policies by companies to respect human rights and be held accountable for any human rights violations associated to their business operations. From the perspective of indigenous peoples, this means that companies should respect our rights over our lands, territories, and resources, and that they need our consent for any activities that they do in terms of the use of our resources, but also if it affects our cultural heritage. So meaning, when we talk of mandatory due diligence, companies cannot just grab our lands anymore. Because if they do that, there should be redress mechanisms, or there should be accountability and access to justice for victims. Why now? Well, as I mentioned, we've experienced massive and even increasing human rights violations associated with business. And this include criminalization, killings, arbitrary arrest and detention, abuse of indigenous women and children is really on the rise, unfortunately. And we need this instrument, especially because they're so weak. There are no accountability mechanisms or redress mechanisms at any level. From local to global, there's hardly no access to justice. So these victims are crying for justice now, and we don't need more victims. What we need are effective redress mechanisms for victims, and finally, for the respect of the rights of indigenous peoples in business operations, right now.
Annabella, over to you. Same question.
When we speak about due diligence, we always think about this frame that the guiding principles gave to us, speaking about the business corporations need to identify, to assess their impact on human rights. But the reality is that they don't. This could help to contribute to go to the activities and to take some measures to prevent. They need to integrate their findings on their own activities and potential impacts on human rights. They need to integrate these findings in all their processes, in all the chain of their activities. It means that they need to integrate even in their own home countries, but also to integrate the impacts in the countries where they are operating. As Joan mentioned before, indigenous peoples in many parts of the world are affected by business activities, but also rural communities, human rights defenders, and business, if they act with due diligence, they should tracking the effectiveness of their measures. They need to communicate in a good way how their impacts are being addressed and where they have problems, looking for advice from experts. They need to be more transparent. They need to be accountable. And of course, as John said, they need to act right now. We cannot wait anymore.
The UN Guiding Principles have been around for 10 years now. It's a relatively long time. The UNGPs have various tools and various ideas, like grievance mechanisms, like other ideas, but they also talk about due diligence quite a lot and give quite a detailed guidance on what due diligence should look like. How can mandatory due diligence help achieve the vision that was set out in the guiding principles of a tangible result for affected communities and a socially sustainable globalization?
So far, we have the limits with the guiding principles that they are not a stronger mechanism. We depend on the will of the business enterprises. We need them, the business enterprises, giving more opportunities to the people to participate in their plans, in their monitoring. But at the same time, one of the issues that I have seen here in the in our region for achieve these tangible results is that in many cases, business are speaking about conflicts, and they are speaking about communities making conflicts and stopping the development. We need to change this idea. They cannot invite human rights defenders to participate in dialogues, and during these dialogues, they are identifying human rights defenders. These defenders are later prosecuted by the justice. Later, they are threatened. So we really need a change.
Thank you very much. Joan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, when we talk about how can mandatory measures help achieve the vision set out by the UNGPs and tangible results, well, for me, the mandatory measures will lead to stronger respect, protection of human rights, and access to justice by victims. With mandatory measures, this will actually be a game changer in the behavior of companies, because they are then compelled to respect human rights. And if they violate human rights, they will be held accountable. So in this regard, for example, when we're talking of the right to express dissent or concern over the potential adverse impacts of corporations, then human rights defenders, including indigenous activists, would then be able to express their views and gather peacefully and hold legitimate actions without fear, because their rights are supposed to be protected. So they can exercise those rights and thereby can lead to better decision-making when affected communities are given the space to express also their views in relation to operations of business. So now when we talk of what will be the tangible results, it will, from my perspective as an Indigenous activist, I can already tell you that there will be a lot of prevention of conflict, because a lot of conflict in Indigenous territories are brought about by business operations that are violating our rights. And these are long-standing conflicts until Indigenous people's rights to their resources, to their livelihoods, to their decision-making is fully respected. It would also result to more equitable and sustainable use of resources. And because there is already a participation of citizens, it's not anymore that the business can do whatever they want. Because part of our right is also to a right to participate in decision making on matters that affects us, including the use of our resources. So if we then participate in the decision making, we can make sure that we also benefit from the use of those resources and that it will not lead to the destruction of the environment. So that means there's a better enabling environment for participation, and then more equitable and sustainable use of resources, and that it's not anymore under, you know, the business as usual profit oriented direction, but make that necessary shift that companies should also listen to those affected by their business operations.
So given this context of continuing abuses that we see on the ground, you both sound relatively optimistic that mandatory human rights due diligence can be an effective tool for communities to compel companies to respect their human rights and their land rights. And given that optimism, I'd like to explore a little bit more with both of you the details of what would you like to see in this type of legislation or this type of regulation or measures, because it can take many forms. It can be hard law, it can be administrative regulations, it can be very different things in different places. So starting now with you, Joanne, this time.
So for me, there are key elements needed in the design of an effective mandatory due diligence. One is a policy level where there is an explicit mention of the rights, both individual rights and collective rights, that has to be respected. And when we talk of individual rights, these include fundamental rights and freedoms, including the right to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, are important rights, and also a due process, the need for due process as fundamental and basic principles of human rights. And then when it relates to indigenous peoples, it is necessary that the policy refers to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and upholding the collective rights of indigenous peoples to our lands, territories, and resources, our right to self-determination, and our right to cultural integrity, and the mechanism to ensure that these integrated rights are respected is to conduct properly the free, prior, and informed consent for indigenous peoples for any business that affects indigenous peoples. And when we talk of consent, it should be based on the collective decision of affected communities and not the interpretation of the state or the business as a broad community support, for example. You cannot approximate consent. Consent is a decision by those affected themselves. So, and with the clear policy, there has to be clear guidelines on how these policies are going to be operationalized. And there is also a clear process of how rights holders are involved or are participates. For example, on the guideline that there should be also a guideline on the conduct of social human rights due diligence, like the social impact studies, right? Where it should include indigenous peoples in that impact study, because it is only us who can tell what would be the cultural impact, because it's our culture. What the others necessarily may not know how, for example, where is our heritage sites? What is the value of our land? Because we don't value our land just for money, not for commercial purposes. They also have spiritual or sacred values to us that has to be put into account. So the level of participation of affected communities, especially rights holders, should be well defined in clear process for their participation. And finally, there should be a mechanism for grievances or redress mechanism and access to justice. And this is a very, very critical and imperative component of a mandatory due diligence process, because this will ensure accountability that when they violate our rights, they cannot get away with it. Companies cannot just simply ignore it. They have to be made accountable, and that communities will get just compensation for the violation of their rights.
That is very clear, Joanne. Thank you. Annabella, from your perspective, what are the key elements that this regulation should have, perhaps looking at it from the angle of human rights defenders?
We need to think not only on human rights defenders, but in the realities of the context here in, for example, in Latin America. And if we see this context, here companies are actors with extreme power, and they are based in very unequal countries, such as our countries. And these business enterprises have the power to co-opt, to corrupt the states. So one challenge we have is if we have business corrupting states, one of the main steps should be that companies must obey the laws, but it's difficult in this situation. They should refrain from corrupting state officials, for example. Thinking on this reality, for us, it is very important the initiative of the legally binding instrument to regulate a business. If we have this, at least when you have countries with fragile states, at least there would be an instrument or a place to go to ask for justice. And of course, victims should be at the center of all human rights policies. We need to ensure that we have instruments to make them do the right in all their actions. We have seen here many human rights defenders prosecuted by the justice because companies control the justice. We are here looking at the human rights defenders attacked by the police and by private security companies because business enterprises control the police forces and the private, of course, security companies. In some countries, as in Guatemala and Honduras, for example, they have the possibility to use also the army against people. So we need to stop that. But to stop this conduct from the businesses, we need to ensure that states are ready to accomplish their duties, controlling companies. And if we have weak states, as we have here in these regions from the south, we need international instruments, stronger instruments, to make them accomplish with their duties.
Thank you very much, Annabella. That's a very important element you're raising about the binding treaty, the power imbalance, and what we can maybe call the corporate capture of government and the corruption issue that makes this field so much more difficult and in your view, necessary to have this mandatory human rights due diligence embedded in hard law. I'd like to go to you, Johannes, now for a little bit of your reflections on the potential reach and extraterritorial implications of the laws that are being discussed currently in Europe.
Thank you very much, Mauricio, for this question. Indeed, these legislations would have extraterritorial effects and impacts, we hope, in a number of ways. So maybe most obviously, of course, these laws would legally require companies to respect human rights and the environment, not just in their home countries, but across their global operations and also across their global value chains, supply chains. So in some sense, these laws would match the global nature of production and business activity that we already see with a global responsibility of these European companies, bigger and smaller companies, for their impacts across the globe, right? And these can be impacts that they cause or contribute to, or impacts that they are directly linked to use some of the UNGP's language here. But it's really about addressing impacts across the globe and in global value chains. And as we all know, the practical tool or the operational principle to implement that responsibility to respect human rights globally is then due diligence, which is not an end in itself. It is a means to an end, and the end is respecting human rights, and due diligence should be the meaningful and effective tool or instrument to get there. And when I'm talking about meaningful and effective due diligence, this would probably or surely have to go beyond just passing down code of conducts or certain requirements, passing those requirements down the supply chain, right, without doing anything actively as a European company. The ambition and scope of the UNGPs is much more transformative in a sense. It really requires, in that case, European brands to build up partnerships within supply chains, to work together with suppliers and jointly address issues in supply chains, also look at their own business models, look at their own purchasing practices and pricing practices, business practices like short delivery times, unrealistic pricing models, etc. Looking at all this to see how this might undermine human rights across value chains, right? Not just simply passing things down the supply chain. And I think that's very important. And yeah, I think that's one very obvious case where we would see extraterritorial impacts. There is also this aspect of access to remedy that both of you already mentioned. And of course, one key ask and benefit of such legislation, we hope, would be improved access to remedy for victims of human rights abuse in third countries, in the Global South, for instance. And we hope civil liability mechanisms, for instance, would then make it easier for victims from those countries to go to EU courts, like courts in EU member states, to hold EU companies accountable under the law of EU countries or the European Union as such. And something which has been very, very difficult so far. I mean, we all know, and our corporate legal accountability colleagues, for instance, in the resource center know how extremely difficult it has been for victims from third countries in particular to hold companies, European companies, accountable before EU courts. I think there is a survey that says in the past 10 years, roughly only one out of 35 cases succeeded where victim from a third country tried to hold an EU company accountable before an EU court, which shows how extremely difficult it is. It also shows how misconstrued arguments by some in the business community are that this legislation would lead to a flood of lawsuits. This is just not true. It's still so difficult for victims. So the least thing we can do, I think, is have a strong civil liability mechanism, strong access to remedy mechanisms in this EU legislation. And of course, this would have some extraterritorial impact. We have making it easier for victims from third countries to go to EU courts.
Thank you very much, Johannes. You know, the issues around value chains globally and supply chains, you know, speak directly with some of the concerns that Annabella raised at the beginning. And the issue around access to remedy for victims speaks directly to the issues that Joanne has been mentioning a lot around what's necessary in this mandatory human rights due diligence. So I'll want to wrap up or start wrapping up this conversation with maybe just one last topic to all the three of you on the next 10 years. So, you know, what opportunities and challenges are there in the next 10 years based on what you have seen in the last 10 years that has happened? I mean, of course, you can always look at the half full of the glass or the half empty of the glass. There's been some progress and some advances in the last 10 years, but in some others, there's been very little progress. Annabella was talking about a binding treaty that potentially could happen in the next 10 years, but it could also take another 20, 30 years to come to reality, unfortunately, because we know how these processes work in the international level. So what do all of you see in the next 10 years with the guidance of the UN Guiding Principles and with this push for mandatory human rights due diligence that could be realistic, and what are the opportunities and challenges for civil society and others in this regard? Let's start with you, Joanne.
Thank you, Mauricio. I'm a bit more on the optimistic side, or more looking into the opportunities. So I would like to believe that given the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, I think that is still a milestone achievement, having that framework. So it's just a question of now developing the policy and having it implemented. So what I see as the opportunity is more development of the policy or laws and going into practice, and because that's what we need. I see, although it's quite slow, that companies by themselves are now also developing their own due diligence and setting up their own grievance mechanisms, which I think is the steps in the right direction. So having it implemented to make those changes on the ground would be a very, in terms of respect for human rights, would really be very positive. Now, of course, I see, as already mentioned, the binding treaty and the EU human rights due diligence are coming up. So we hope that in this decade, it will also come up. Oh, I also want to tie this with the global agenda on sustainable development, of which the business is one of the key partners, no? The public-private partnership. So if the public-private partnership will be guided by the UN guiding principles in practice, that would really accelerate, no? And advance the SDGs in all its dimensions, if it is fully in line with the vision and the principles of the UNGPs. But I also see the opportunity, and we always have to also look at in the equation what communities are doing, and they're fighting back. And that is a good sign that they're fighting back, that communities are asserting and defending their rights on the ground, and that we should encourage that for people to claim the space, claim their right to decide for their future. And this is an opportunity that we need to also support and build solidarity and advance, because it's also in the way communities claim their rights that changes on the ground is going to happen.
Thank you. Anabella, over to you.
Thank you, Mauricio. Yes, I like the how is John formulating this very optimistic idea of the future. I also want to be optimistic. I think that due diligence is coming up, but when we speak about public-private partnerships, it's not only an issue to be guided by the guiding principles, but also these kind of partnerships should be conditioned by donor states, by markets, by the international cooperation. I mean, we need to have the way to enforce the public-private partnerships where are more linked with the human rights and the human rights duties. I think one opportunity we are, at least in this region, looking more and more is that in the fighting of corruption, we have had in Latin America many different kind of experiences of fighting corruption. And I think we can take some lessons learned from these experiences and think more on these international mechanisms with independent experts, international experts, helping states to do what they should do. It means, for example, in Guatemala, we have had the International Commission Against Impunity, a body from the UN that we had around 10 years working in Guatemala. But this experience showed us that if you really want to track corruption, you can find that some business are linked with the corruption, and you need to bring them to the justice. We need to ensure that there is the capability to address this huge power that business have. And we can have not only commissions against impunity or corruption, but we could have, for example, more independent mechanisms, international mechanisms, to investigate, for example, damages to the water or environment. helping communities, because as Johannes pointed out, for communities it's very difficult to bring the proofs to the justice and show that what they are looking in their quotidianity is actually provoked by the business activities. And of course, I am very optimistic with the future of the legally binding instrument. But of course, I know that this will take many years. And in the meantime, communities are fighting. Communities are using all the mechanisms at their disposition. They are looking for mechanisms, sometimes with the human rights mechanisms in the UN, the regional mechanisms of human rights, but also the complaint mechanisms of the international financial institutions. They are using the complaint mechanisms of some business enterprises. They are going to their own states with cases, and they try to document cases. So people is really trying to make their human rights be respected. But we need to ensure that they have enough support from the international community to continue with their search for justice and a better world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Annabella. Johannes?
Yes, thank you. I also see both opportunities and challenges related to the UNGPs in the next 10 years. Let me start maybe with the challenges. I think it's a major step, of course, that we have these UNGPs as a common standard and that everybody can refer to, companies, civil society, policymakers, and this is what is happening, I think, in the mandatory due diligence debate as well. I think what we all need to make sure jointly is that due diligence does not become a tick box process or a meaningless, shallow exercise, but really something meaningful that can make a difference to people on the ground in the end, right? To the rights holders. These are the people that are at the center of the UNGPs. There is one very knowledgeable person that always points out that even UNGP's pillar 2, which is about respecting human rights and about what companies need to do, is in the end about the people that are meant to benefit from these corporate actions, not about the companies. It's about the people. And yeah, we really need to make sure that due diligence has tangible results for people. And this means, as I alluded to before, we need to go beyond overly compliance-based or audit-driven approaches, for instance, towards approaches, where really meaningful interaction and long-term relationships and a lot of trust is built up and takes place between brands, companies, and their suppliers, but also between brands, suppliers, and local stakeholders, rights holders, civil society, defenders. And I think this is one of the key facts, actually, one of the key factors that can drive due diligence beyond tick box approaches or beyond overly managerial or formalistic approaches. It's really the exchange and constant feedback with and from local stakeholders and rights holders, talking to the people, listening to the people as a brand, taking their concerns very seriously, respecting their right to say no to dissent. And I think that's to one extent the challenge, but also the opportunity. I think if we really make sure due diligence, as I said, goes beyond tick box approach towards something really meaningful, that's a big, big opportunity. It can be the game changer that I think Joanne mentioned, really promoting a mind shift within companies, where companies not just add some, I don't know, CSR-y additional process to what they are anyways doing as their business, but really also thinking about, okay, how can my business generally become more sustainable, and how can due diligence help us achieve that? to conclude with, the sole measure of success of due diligence legislation is really tangible benefits for rights holders and victims and potentially affected people. And if we achieve this, and I'm optimistic that we can achieve this, we've come a long way from reporting transparency-focused legislation towards legislation that really mandates action by companies. We've come this way, and I'm optimistic that we'll achieve what I just outlined, tangible outcomes for rights holders. And I'm optimistic to conclude that the EU process can also give additional momentum to the UN treaty process, for instance, which I know is currently slightly ignored, unfortunately, by many EU governments. But I sincerely hope this will change. And I mean, yeah, I think we as NGOs advocate for action on all these levels, national, regional, and international.
In many respects, we have only started touching on many of these issues, but I think today we managed to discuss, you know, very important issues for communities on the ground, for social leaders, for indigenous leaders, and human rights defenders on the issue of mandatory human rights due diligence. I also hope that this podcast is useful for companies, governments, and decision makers and policy makers that can hear directly from the brilliant practitioners and activists that we had today with us in this podcast. So, Anabella Cibrian, Joan Carling, Johannes Blankenbach, I would like to thank you very much for giving us your generous time today, discussing with us and speaking with us today about these important issues. And we look forward to continue working with you and speaking with you in the next future. Thank you again, and have a good day.
Thank you for listening to This Way Up from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at BHRRC and let us know what you think. Please keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share on your networks.